back the Iranian program by one iota. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.
Two suicide bombers were killed in Somalia before they could disrupt a meeting with hundreds of the country's elders. Police say the would-be bombers were killed before they could gain entry to a building in Mogadishu, where participants were debating the country's new constitution. India's government is ordering an investigation into the massive power failure that left 620 million people without electricity. Three of the country's power grids shut down Tuesday afternoon. The country's top power officials say electricity has been restored to most of those individuals. Once again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 38 points at 13,047. I'm Jim Howard, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 51 years of service to music education, now offering private lesson instruction for students of all ages. They also feature guitars, amplifiers, digital pianos, software, and sound equipment in the Pro Sound Center at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
There was a time when knowledge rested in a relatively small number of places, starting out with people's heads and then going into things that we call books and then going into things that we call libraries. Well, today, not only is there more to know, but there are also more places to find it than ever before. And here's the question: has all of this additional knowledge made us smarter or just more confused? This morning, in this hour of Focus, we are talking with David Weinberger from Harvard University's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. And he is someone who has done a lot of writing and thinking about the relationship between those two things, Internet and Society. And we'll be talking about his most recent book, and the title is Too Big to Know: Rethinking Knowledge Now That Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. The book is published by Basic Books. It looks at the ways which, in fact, the Internet has made the world a little bit messier, but also much richer in information. And he argues that it's a real opportunity for us to become smarter than ever. As I mentioned, our guest, David Weinberger, is a senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. He's also co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Lab and has authored a number of books, among them Small Pieces Loosely Joined, Everything is Miscellaneous. He's also the co-author of the Clue Train Manifesto, and his work has appeared in a lot of other places. He's been widely interviewed and has spoken a lot about these subjects, and we're pleased to have him with us. And Dr. Weinberger, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I think I'm interested maybe in having you talk a little bit about Alvin Toffler, just because here in the book early on you refer to the fact that way back in 1970, in the last century, he wrote this book that a lot of people still think has something to say, this book, Future Shock. And one of the things that he talked about was information overload. The idea being that we'd get to the point where there was so much information, we'd just be literally drowning in this sea of information, then it would be more than we could handle. And we seem to be at that point, and yet it seems that we handle it fairly well, or at least we've come to accept that that is just the way the world is, and nobody's head has exploded lately because there was too much information. I think at one time, though, we actually worried that that might happen.
Yes, I mean, the term information overload was coined not by Toffler, but he popularized it for sure in 1970 in Future Shock. It was coined as an analog to sensory overload, which is a term that comes from the 1950s. And the idea with sensory overload was that if there are too many sensations, you're at a Grateful Dead concert and there's all the lights and the sounds and the smells, that you that might impair your sensory system and you would fall over a gibbering mass and frothing at the mouth and permanent damage might be done. Sensory overload actually looks like it. The term became popular primarily as parents were being warned about the effects of drugs on their kids in the 1960s. And so the term information overload was coined as the information age took root, and it was decided, and I think maybe on pretty specious grounds, that in fact brains are information processors, and if that's the case, then maybe there's the same type of problem, not for sensation, but for information. And so information overload would also, and this Toffler says that sanity hinges upon this, that too much information could have the same sort of effect and you would fall over, again, a gibbering mass with frothing at the mouth. But what's happened over time first of all, the 1970s idea of information overload is now laughable to us. If you look at, for example, a 1974 study that some marketers did, some researchers, they gave 192 housewives, as they were known, 16 different brands of grocery items with 16 different items on the label. And it was discovered that the poor housewives, their cognitive abilities decreased if they were given simply that much information. So 16 brands, 16 pieces of information about each, that's laughable now for information overload. But the bigger change is the one that you point to, namely that when we talk about information overload now, we generally don't mean that it's a symptom, a syndrome that affects an individual who's going to fall over. We talk about it as just a factor of in the environment. It's a characteristic of how we live, that there's too much information. And we are not falling over and gibbering. In fact, we are doing remarkably well. And the more common complaint is, I'm not getting the right information. I need more information. It's too hard to get the next piece of information. The 1970s view of information overload pretty much has not materialized.
And it also seems to be the case that if you look back and you sample the writings of thinkers going actually a long way back, that there, people were always complaining about this. They were always saying, oh, there is just too much to know. How can any one person possibly get a handle on this? And they were looking to other people to be the ones to try to narrow the field and to say to them, okay, really, I got it for you. I got a handle on it. I can tell you what really is important, what you really need to know. And so then we get to the point where that gets put down on a piece of paper. But it seems that this worry about who could possibly know everything you need to know or that there is to know, that is not a new worry.
No. It's a very old worry. And Clay Shirky, the magnificent and very important thinker, Clay Shirky, recently put it like this, that there's no such thing as information overload. There's only filter failure. Mm-hmm. And he means by this, I think, to provide some comfort to us, some historical continuity. It's always been the case that we have periodically felt overwhelmed, but then we've devised better ways of filtering. The huge amount of knowledge and information that we've always been surrounded by. But even though I think that's a wonderful and wise way of putting it, that it's just filter failure, I think it's also important to notice the discontinuities because they are, I believe, really epical. We are in a new age because of these sorts of discontinuities. Something very different is going on, and especially with knowledge. So that, for example, the idea of filtering, how we filter, has changed fundamentally, not simply that now everybody gets to be a filter, although that's huge. That by itself is huge. We invested so much authority and prestige and importance in the handful of people who used to filter out onto the paper media. So the fact that who gets to filter now has changed is by itself large. But there's a change in the very nature of filtering that is bringing about a change in the nature of knowledge. So in the physical world, when you're filtering books, or let's say you are on the selection committee, the acquisition committee of your local public library, and thank you for doing that good work, by the way. So you would select among the million books that are published each year. You would select the tiny handful that make it onto the shelves. And the users of the library would be delighted because they come in and they see the shelves of all these shiny, new, wonderful books. What they don't see is the near million books in the sad trucks backing away from the library. The filtering used to mean removing that which didn't make it through the filter. But that's not how we filter online. The equivalent online is if you or I decide to filter the top business stories of the month or whatever on our blog. So we go through and we pick them and we put in links. All the ones that didn't make it onto our list, they're still completely available. The manuscripts that used to be, still are, sent into publishers and are rejected, they're completely unavailable. On the web, when you filter, you only bring things forward. You filter forward. You reduce the number of clicks that it takes for somebody to get to something. But all the other material is still there, could show up in a search or in an email that gets passed around or a social networking site or wherever. And so the very notion of filtering as removing has changed. And I think that is changing the basic shape and function of knowledge in our culture.
Well, I mean, to come back to the notion of filtering in a second, but I guess I also think it's I never really quite thought of the book as an information filter, but it is in the sense that somebody has taken on this subject of the book, has decided what really matters, has put their arguments down, has anticipated the counter arguments other people will make and already responded to those. And the idea is that, okay, now everything you need to know is within the covers of this book. And if there's something else, well, you can come and ask me. So the book and the author and the author expert, they are information filters.
Yes. And of course, there's value in that. And I say that not just to somebody who's written a book. There is continuing value in providing that. But we've taken some of the limitations of books due to their physical nature. And we have, in my view, we've exalted those limitations as if they are part of knowledge itself. But that's not the case. So just what you say, the author makes decisions about what's going to be in the book, how to tell the story so that it leads the reader from A to Z, but necessarily, first of all, leaves out a huge amount, makes decisions about what's going to get into, say, the textbook or into the nonfiction book or whatever, leaving out huge amounts of things that might well be interesting, but you just can't get them all in. And you have to do that because books as physical are both highly limited, they're very short, and they are disconnected. Books, for all of their wonderfulness, are a disconnected medium. That's maybe the fundamental limitation that we have structured our idea of knowledge around, that because readers can't get from an idea in the book to the next idea, they can't just click on the word and go magically retrieve the information. It becomes the job of the scholar and the writer to try to get everything in one place as if that's a natural shape for knowledge, but it's not. It's a restriction based upon the limitations of the old media. And we know this because as soon as knowledge starts to hit the web, which is hyperlinked and has immense capacity and can string together pieces in strong ways or weak ways, as soon as knowledge hits the web, it immediately takes on a different shape. And I actually want to say a more useful and in some weird sense a more natural shape.
Our guest, let me just quickly introduce a guest again, is David Weinberger. He's a senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. And we're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. Basic Books is the publisher. Questions, welcome 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. And I don't know if this gets us into another area entirely, but to come back to the notion of filtering and whether there's filtering going on and who's doing it, I think that for most people, the Internet, having access to the Internet, gives you access to just a stunning amount of information. However, chances are, I think most people, what they're going to do, if they know a specific place they want to go, they can go there, but they're going to use a search engine. And you don't have to know too much about search engines to know that they are also doing filtering. So you do a search for something, and it can seem very impressive when it comes up and tells you, I found a million hits for you on what it is you're looking for. Well, that's great, but you're not going to look at those million hits. You're probably going to look at the first 5 or 10. Maybe you'll look at the first 50. But that means that there's an awful lot of stuff there that you're not even going to look at. And then that also means there's a lot of stuff that never got on that list, even though there were a million hits. So what does that all tell us about the fact that there is continued filtering going on?
Well, for one thing, it tells us that users, out of the economic interests of the search engines, users are constantly being told that there is basically an endless amount of information. The old sense that we had because we were dealing with physical objects, was that, you know, a library could be really, really big. It could be a city block. A bookstore could have, you know, the Strand used bookstore. A bookstore in New York used to advertise how many miles of shelves. I think there's something like 503 miles of shelves in the Library of Congress. But still, you can wrap your mind around that. It's, knowledge seemed to fit into human size containers. Now we're constantly being told, reminded, that actually it never did, and it currently doesn't. But this does give an enormous amount of power to search engines. The news yesterday from Google that they apparently are favoring comments made on their own social networking site, Google Plus, bringing those up in the search results page. It's very distressing. Presumably they're doing that for economic reasons, not because it's actually information that people want. I mean, I find that very, very disturbing and disappointing in Google, and something we need to worry about. On the other hand, search engines are not the only place we go for knowledge. In fact, we go to search engines when we don't know where else to look. And they're wonderful. They're amazing inventions. But you go there when you need a quick answer and you don't know where else to look. If there's a field in which you're particularly knowledgeable, whether it's your hobby or your job or your town, you frequently have developed informal networks of resources and people that you can consult. You have a set of people you know you can ask about if you care about FCC policy, you have a set of people and a mechanism now for asking them, for throwing a question onto a mailing list or onto the site that you go to or the blogs that you read. So search engines are profoundly important, but they're not the only place that we find or develop knowledge. For the knowledge that matters most to us, frequently we are using other resources, which tend to be webs and networks, which are, I think, is a really interesting development.
So just to go back again to the advantages or the limitations of the book and the expert, there would have been a time when I'm maybe overdrawing this, but there would have been a time when the way we dealt with all the information was we had people who were appointed to be experts, or maybe they appointed themselves, and they accumulated the knowledge in that area, and they put it between the pages of the book so that if you wanted to learn about the subject, you could get the book, and they would say to you, here's my book, you read this, and when you're done, you're done. Now, maybe it wasn't too long before it came to the point where you couldn't just do that with one book. Maybe you'd have to read five books. But, you know, you could imagine that you could read what there was and that was it. Well, we're long past that point where the thing is you almost feel like whatever it is you're interested in learning about or getting at whatever question you want an answer to, it's as if you're never done. You're never going to be done now. And I suppose that can either – you can either say, well, that's great, because then that means inquiry and thinking and ideas and new stuff are going to go on forever. But then there is something maybe a little disconcerting about the idea, because then the other idea will be, well, there is never going to be an answer to anything. So we'll never really know anything for sure, because there's always going to be some new angle or some new piece of information or somebody coming along with a new way of looking at it, and something about that's unsettling.
Absolutely. But the reason I titled the book Too Big to Know, which, by the way, came out shortly, a few months after a really good book by Ann Blair called Too Much to Know came out. Ann Blair's book is exactly about the fact that we've suffered from information overload throughout our history. So the reason I called it Too Big to Know is that it's the world that's too big to know. The world is too big to know. Our brains are very small. The universe is very, very large. And don't you think that a medium of knowledge that reflects the fact that there is way too much and what we know never fully settles down is a more true reflection of our position as small creatures in a large universe? It seems to me that this for all of the dangers, and we do need to talk about them, that for all of that, the new realm of knowledge is actually truer to our situation than the old, more comforting one was. Mm. And I'll say one more thing. I mean, mm-hmm. Sort of a broader way of putting the point that you just made, which I think is a really, really important one, David. In the West, we've constructed a system of knowledge over the past 2,500 years. Conventionally, you know, you start with Athens, ancient Greece. We've constructed a system of knowledge that effectively consists of a series of stopping points. So you have a question, you go to an expert or the book that the expert wrote, you got your answer, and you can stop asking. You don't have to repeat the experiments. You can just take the expert's word for it. And usually that's right. I mean, this system of knowledge of stopping points is incredibly effective. It's what has enabled us to progress as a species. It's a big deal if we're moving from that, as I think we are. Because as you say, in the new world where knowledge is being built and discussed and distributed, that's a network of people and ideas that are very loosely connected, where that is constructed primarily not out of containers like books, but out of hyperlinks, which means you can always find more. It's as if knowledge has gone from being a series of stopping points to being a series of temptations to learn more, to explore more, to find what contradicts the thing that you just read. And so knowledge doesn't settle. We agree on some facts, at least most people will agree on a set of facts. We get more and more facts all the time. But the interesting discussions of knowledge, how these pieces go together, no, that is now profoundly unsettled. And it is an unsettling phenomenon for sure.
Here's an interesting thought that comes in from somebody who's listening and sends in an email. And the person writes, "My friends and I have bemoaned the vast amount of information on the Internet for some time." She goes on to write, "Gone are the days when a discussion on a topic can last for hours as we debated who did what when. Now, within minutes of the beginning of the debate, someone will pull out their phones with a cry of Google it." And she says, "I really feel as though this has diminished communication, the ability to disagree and continue a conversation, and lessens what people feel is necessary to actually remember on their own."
Well, you know, Plato agrees. But Plato was talking about writing, not about the Internet. And I think most of us have, you know, we're pretty much in favor of writing. There's certainly the ability to just reach into the Internet, pull out a fact, and stop a conversation with that fact is worrisome, especially since the fact may be wrong. You know, everybody knows, I hope, the Internet is a swirl of right and wrong, truth and falsity. And, you know, that's a bad thing. But that's in some ways either an old-style conversation in which facts are used as weapons to shut down the discussion, or it's centering on something that's not all that interesting because it's resolved by a simple fact. Most of our discussions are, it's hard to generalize, but the sorts of passionate discussions that people have and they think about when they're thinking about the best conversations they had over coffee or over beer and that went on for hours are not simple factual matters. They're not arguing about what's the population of metropolitan Chicago. They're arguing about things that are unsettled, where there's room for lots of interesting, nuanced disagreement. The ability to grab a fact seems to me to be generally, not always, but generally actually an aid to our moving conversations forward. But maybe I'm just having different sorts of conversations. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I do. I think that same thing. I suppose it depends on what it is that we're talking about. If it indeed is. A question about something, you know, someone says, well, what was the date of the French Revolution? Well, you know, I think if you don't know that, you can Google it and that's fine. But then that doesn't tell you what the implications of the French Revolution was or what it meant for European politics or what it meant for the history of the world or connections between the French Revolution and the American Revolution. It seems that those conversations can go on for a long time once you've established some sort of basic fact, like, well, when did this happen, or who was responsible, or whatever.
You know, a different sort of example, you know, a discussion about whether Viggo Mortensen is a good actor or not can go on forever, but somebody says, I hated him in All the President's Men, and you can now IMDb it and instantly say, no, he wasn't in that. He was 5 years old or whatever it was.
Exactly. All right.
That sort of lookup is helpful. The thing is that in general, I think one of the things that the Internet is teaching us, which is a very broad sort of claim and essentially untrue because the internet is different to different people. Nevertheless, I'm going to continue with the pointless generalization, is that we had hoped as a result of the Enlightenment, we'd been led to believe and hope that that facts will serve as a foundation for discussion that will enable us to come to agreement. So this is the famous Daniel Patrick Moynihan quote that everybody's entitled to his own opinion but not his own facts, which offers a type of comfort and hope that, yeah, well, you know, we hear all these disagreements, but if we all just focused on the facts, we would agree. And I think one of the things that the internet teaches us is that we're not going to agree. This is not – so let me be careful. There are facts. There are right and wrong statements. I have no problem with that. But it doesn't matter because even when there are right and wrong statements, we're not going to agree about them. We're just not. There is no agreement on the web. It's not like we're now coming to agreement because we're all talking and we all have access. We're not going to agree. Facts are really important. I am 100% in favor of fact-based policymaking and the like. But they're not going to do the thing that we had been told they're going to do, which is to drive out disagreement and to bring us to resolution on issues. Mm. It's just not going to happen.
We have another caller to talk with, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, this is Vicky. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have several comments, and I had to organize them, of course. It's just information that you all are providing is kind of flooding me with ideas. But I've spent a career in helping people manage data and making it useful. So I was both a trainer and a database administrator and found my effective niche in my career with helping executives reach decisions based on compiling data and making it useful. So I've spent a lot of time, several decades in this endeavor, and found that indeed they needed me to make sense, to make data sensible to them so that they could make decisions for organizations, large organizations. And, you know, it's a fascinating field to work in and to have watched it grow from floppy disks and punch cards to what we have now. You know, to me, the essence of what I did was help compile this data, and I think that part of the reason people get overwhelmed, I was also a trainer for a while, is that it is so new to them, and there is so much information. I absolutely agree with that point that you've made. But I'm also interested in how this connects to a teaching method I studied once for my children, which is working in a sort of a web-based, unfortunately, I don't remember the who proposed this and which academic brought up this idea, but, you know, their observation was basically that children don't really learn linear fashion, and neither do we. We tend to invest ourselves in a topic, learn everything we can about it, and it is very much more in a sort of a web-based, let's make connections. That's the way the brain works. So I think you're right when you say that the internet does that for us and changes the way that we think because we are not spending as much time just sitting down and reading a book from beginning to end. On the other hand, I think books have a fascinating benefit in the sense that everything that I know about a topic, if I'm going to write a book, has to be edited down to the most essential items instead of being never-ending. So I think there's some benefit to actually having books shortened into a chunks, so to speak. I think it's nice to have information sometimes chunked for me. I like that. I do also like hyperlinks, but I like the fact that sometimes when I sit down with an actual book, I don't have to worry about hyperlinks. I can just read the book. And my concern, and I wanted to get your comment on this, is that I think we're at this cutting edge of changing the way that our brains interact with this information. And there was a show somewhere on NPR the other day about, you know, being able to point is actually a very old brain sort of method of when we're children, we point and we get what we want, and now we have technology that lets us point and get what we want. I'm interested in how the brain, my ability to concentrate may be different than my children's ability to concentrate just by the nature of the fact that I was raised on books, and they are raised on books and computers. And what happens with my grandchildren really don't spend any time really concentrating in that way. Now, I'm not saying that's all bad. I think that can be maybe the way that our brains are supposed to be evolving, And I like the fact that I don't have to remember as many details. I can go and reach those on my phone or on the internet. I think that maybe we're supposed to be moving to the place where our brains operate at a different level, because we are no longer tied to exactly what are the facts, but perhaps that last comment that you made about having conversations about what does that mean, maybe those are more important. But the other point I wanted to make is that I certainly rely on experts when I have something, whether it's astronomy or the internet or healthcare. I rely on people that I trust and I know the way that they think, and sometimes that's on the internet, sometimes it's a personal connection. But I certainly think that all this information makes the universe seem really, really rather large, whether we're talking about the universe physically or in information technology. So I'll take your comments off the air, but thanks for the show.
Okay, well, thank you. There's a lot. We could go for the rest of the morning.
Absolutely.
And what would you like to pick out of that to talk about?
Let's see. So, Vicki, those are fantastic issues, but you brought up decisions, education, the value of chunking information. Are our brains changing, and the role of experts? So given this lovely menu, I'm going to go to education and just say one thing about that. You can look at yes, children seem not to learn in a linear fashion. I think one of the ways of looking at what the web is providing, and this is a positive thing, I believe, is that when the web is composed quite literally out of links, and links are almost always an expression of human interest. That is, if I link to you, it's because I think that there's some reason why what you're writing or showing matters, and I want people who are reading me to go over there to see what you're doing, which is fundamentally a way of acknowledging implicitly that the world consists of lots of people, the world matters to each of these people, and the world matters in a different way to each of these people. I might add that those are the fundamental properties of being moral. If you lack any of those, then you're a sociopath. If you don't recognize the world consists of people to whom the world matters in their own way, you know. So we all recognize that. The very architecture of the web reflects that. And furthermore, because the links express human interest, that's why I think that's the core reason why so many of us find the web so fascinating, that people talk about internet addiction and certainly about internet as a distraction. It's because it's so interesting, because it's reflecting what we humans are interested in. But for educators, for the process of education, what is a higher value to instill in your children through the educational process than the idea that the world is really, really interesting, way more interesting than the old media could ever have let us know, because the range of topics was so small and the time was so short, way more interesting than we can even imagine, endlessly, endlessly worth exploring. That seems to me to be a core value that educators try to give as a gift to our students, to our children. That is a value that is manifest on the web.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus with David Weinberger. He's a senior researcher at the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard University. We're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his new book, Too Big to Know. We'll take just a very short break here, and then we'll continue our conversation. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, how Paul Ryan captured the GOP. We talk with Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker about the chair of the House Budget Committee. Lizza says if you want to imagine what Republicans would do if they win in November, the person to understand is Paul Ryan. Lizza's article about Ryan is in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program, so as you listen, keep in mind, we will not be taking calls.
The guest in this hour, David Weinberger. He's a senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. He's the co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Lab and author of a number of books, Small Pieces Loosely Joined,
Everything is Miscellaneous. He's co-author of the book The Clue Train Manifesto and the new one that is out now by Basic Books, Too Big to Know. And let's talk with someone else in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I had an interesting question, observation I've noticed for myself. I wonder if it's common. You know, with all the pop-ups on the Internet, I tend to be very focused to look at just what I'm looking for. When I'm reading items now, I miss the stuff on the periphery because I've been sort of self-trained to avoid those things. I was wondering if that's kind of a common phenomena. I'll get off the air and just listen. Thank you.
Okay. Is that something you have a thought about?
It's fascinating. I have not heard of that. Doesn't mean that it's not common. It's just maybe the people haven't noticed that they're doing it.
All right.
I don't know.
Well, that's about the best answer we can give to that. But, of course, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I wanted to go back to the previous caller, one before this one, raised this question. She was thinking about, wondering how it is that as a result of being exposed to the Internet and this avenue of learning things, how it is maybe the way that she thinks is different from the way that her children think. And I guess I'm wondering what you think about one of the concerns that people have raised, not just about children, but maybe about all of us, that the way information is presented on the Internet, particularly because we now have these links and you can start one place and then go to another place and go to another place and maybe take an interesting trip. But the argument has been made that what this has done is that it has eroded our ability to, in a sustained way, to think deeply about a single subject. And then, in fact, what it's doing is that it's giving us a kind of attention deficit disorder. Our minds flit from thing to thing and can't focus on one thing for a long period of time. And I wonder what you think about that, whether you think that, in fact, is the case and something to worry about.
Well, I think there's a good possibility that it is the case, and whether it's because of some deep structural change in our brain or simply everything we do changes our brain. That's the point of brains, of course. But this may be a deep structural change or it may not be. It may be a cultural change. It is not reflected. It doesn't matter from my point of view whether it's reflected in brain anatomy or not. What matters is it a phenomenon? Are we changing how we think? And it seems to me that, there's some pretty good evidence that we do think differently and not entirely for the better. It seems to me I've been mainly hitting on positive things, and overall I am quite optimistic about what this new infrastructure is enabling us to know. If you are interested in knowledge, if that's your profession or it's your avocation, if you are a seeker of knowledge, then I think it's pretty clear that this is the greatest time in human history to be alive for pursuing knowledge. If you're not, if you have never been taught how to do that by the educational system, by librarians, by your parents, then it can be a terrible time for getting lost in byways of falsity and hatred, and having those views get amplified and set in your mind and in your soul. So there are absolutely dangers here as well, and that sort of parenthetical remark that I just made is by no means sufficient to deal with, to talk about those dangers. It's a very important big topic. Right. It does seem that, so rather than asking the really hard question, which is how are our brains thinking about knowledge, it might be useful to think instead about how knowledge is being presented, what the medium of knowledge is doing to the structure of knowledge. And it is certainly the case that this new medium is not calling forth, is not dominated by long-form books online books that start at A and get to Z over the course of 350 dense pages of magnificently connected thought. That is not what's characteristic of knowledge in the age of the Internet. You can do that. You can post it on the net. That is done. It's not the characteristic. The characteristic are, in fact, these webs of loosely connected ideas that contain multiple people at various levels of expertise and with varying credentials who are disagreeing with one another in various ways. They are saying different things. That is the shape of knowledge on the Internet. One can expect, therefore, that it will change the way that we think and how we think about knowledge. But the one thing I think we can say with some confidence is knowledge looks way, way different in its shape on the net than it does in books.
Well, I'm sure that people would argue that the great opportunity that the net gives us for advancing knowledge is, in fact, that it's a place for people to argue, in the sense that, you know, one person puts their, and that's what really should happen, that one person puts their ideas out there, that other people look at them and then say, no, this is wrong, and hopefully they'll say, and I'll tell you why it's wrong. So then you have an argument, you have reassessment, and the first person rethinks their ideas, and you know, everybody rethinks. So, you know, by that process, and it makes a place where that can take place much more easily than that ever could happen before.
Yes, absolutely. To argue, to disagree, but also to engage in all the other sorts of differences that we have, including, for example, elaborating on an idea, making something, not arguing with what you've just posted, but taking it and showing, let me explain part of what you meant. Let me explain it further. Let me apply it to a new field and have other people say, no, you misapplied it, or it doesn't work here, or it does work here, or all of the different ways, taking a highly technical topic and explaining it in ways that non-technical people can understand. This has been an amazing thing that's occurred in our culture, that any topic in the news, whether it's faster than light neutrinos or the intricacies of economics, when it makes a splash, part of the splash is that there will be people explaining what this means to people who otherwise don't have the expertise to understand it. That's a very important change in how knowledge exists in the world.
And at the same time, I can see why scholars would think that was very exciting, and also though why that might lead to some frustration among non-scholars. Because it would have been an illusion before to know that here's the question, here's the answer, we're done. That now I think what people their frustration and perhaps mostly we see that in science maybe their frustration people have is that we're never done. It goes back to this idea that we're never done and this feeling like nobody ever really knows anything for sure. And so depending on how you look at that, either you can say, well, that's very exciting, because that means that there are no limits to knowledge. But on the other hand, some people would say, well, come on. you know, yesterday you told me this, and today you're telling me this, and, you know, what am I to think?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that that's as widespread a issue as it sounds like. Because the knowledge is never done, but we are all the time, we decide that we're done with some topic. We've read enough about faster than light neutrino controversy, or the economic meltdown, the Greek euro controversy. We've reached our limit of interest and we stop. So we stop thinking, well, now we've learned something. And we may realize or recognize that there's dispute about this or that at varying levels, but we do come to rest. It's just our rest. The huge danger is that we may not be very good at knowing. We're not very good at knowing where to come to rest. We are frequently, in these instances, dealing in topics that we're a layperson. And so we are trusting some source that source is reliable and accurate and all the rest of it. And we can absolutely be wrong. But I don't think that we come out of the web thinking everything is false, everything is true, I can never know anything. I think instead we follow our interests till they come to an end. We feel fairly satisfied. And as a good sort of liberal, I hope that we remember that along the way we've encountered lots of disagreements, so that we shouldn't be too confident that what we think is right is right.
Well, we have about 5 or 6 minutes, and the lines are full. I will get in as many callers as we can. So we'll go next to someone in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. What about multitasking, especially in the workplace? You know, people are doing more and more work. There's a great deal of stress. You know, the other day I was in, you know, we're up to, in these places now, 2 screens. There must be 3 screens. But what's your feeling about multitasking? You know, it seems to me that it's not as efficient as focusing. People have, you know, maybe two or three things going on at the same time and adding these additional screens and all that kind of thing. So I'll go off and let you comment.
All right.
Well, there's some evidence that multitasking is actually just fast task switching, and there's always a price for switching tasks. There's some loss of context and regaining of context. And a recent study by Allison Head, some research into what students are actually doing on their computers when they're in the library during exam period, high-stress exam period. She actually looked, with their permission, of course, at what they were doing on their screens, and they were not actually doing what we would think of as multitasking. They were handling the information needs very with a lot of skill. They were focused. They were popping out every 20 minutes in some cases to look to check in on their friends at Facebook. But that's not exactly multitasking. That was a little reward for having a chunk of work. So at least that little bit of evidence, that study suggests that students are not doing as much multitasking as we may have been led to believe, and probably for the reasons that the caller suggests.
All right. And to another caller. This is someone on a cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just two things real quick. I really appreciate this program. You may have already touched on it. It seems to me that Crane Britton at Harvard several decades ago wrote about cumulative and non-cumulative knowledge, which seems a little bit helpful as categories, but that's just a pop in the air there that I feel is a good distinction. But as far as leadership, it seems like a doctor who takes care of me has an advantage if I know a little bit more going in than I would otherwise. But the Arab Spring would have never taken place if there were not an internet. So there's also small leadership that benefits by this, but large leadership, everybody confesses, is much more complex and highly pressured now because of the internet. Would you care to comment on that?
I think it's really fascinating to watch new models of leadership emerge, leadership as a networked phenomenon, as opposed to a leader being a single individual that everybody looks to who has particular responsibilities and authorities. In some of the more successful internet-based collaborations, whether it's Wikipedia, a bunch of other things as well, you can see a different model of leadership, one in which it's much more of a networked and shared responsibility. That, to me, is a very, very interesting development, because the old style of leadership in which a single person takes charge over a large domain, it doesn't scale up very well. The domains are getting very, very big because the internet is so capacious. And so the old model of a single person who makes those decisions, it's you have to reduce the information so much to fit into that single person's cranium that there are distinct disadvantages to that old style of leadership.
Here, we're coming down to about the last couple of minutes here. Another question that has come in by email that I think is interesting. I'd like to hear what you would say. The listener says, do you think that children who have regular internet exposure are at an advantage or disadvantage to those who do not, or do you think ultimately that won't matter to how either of those children thinks or processes information?
Well, I may not be answering this the way the questioner expects, but I would think I have to say yes. It depends a lot on what the child is doing with the internet. I mean, you could use the internet simply as a way of delivering old-style TV, and then, no, not a lot of advantage. Mm-hmm. But if, assuming the child is being taught how to roam and browse and explore, then the internet becomes, I think, a very valuable tool, not only for gathering information, but for modeling what it means to be a curious creature.
We're now so getting to the point where, I mean, we're sort of at the point where more and more people have 24-hour on-demand internet access from small, easily portable, sometimes pocket-sized devices. And one scarcely knows where you go from here other than the expectation that more and more people will have them. They'll be smaller and faster. And do you have some thoughts about where do you think this is going to go from here now?
Well, nothing that nobody else doesn't think. I assume we're going to have more and cheaper devices, and they'll be smaller, they'll be embedded, they'll be everywhere. I think the larger risk is to the internet itself, as legislation like the Stop Online Privacy Act in the House and the equivalent Protect IP Act in the Senate are on the verge of passing, which would give our government the ability to decide to shut down sites because of alleged copyright violations without any judicial procedure or any recourse. That threatens to undo so much of the openness of the net that for me is the bigger unknown. We can assume hardware proliferation, internet proliferation, maybe not at the pace that we would like in this country, but the nature of the net itself is now at risk. And yes, that was a political statement.
There we will stop, although I'm sure this is a subject that we will come back to again on another day. But for now, we want to say thanks to our guest, David Weinberger. He's a senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. His most recent book, if you'd like to look at it, is Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. It's published by Basic Books. He has several books out, so you can look at them. Also, we want to say thanks to Orpha Rivera, who's the technical director at Harvard on the other end of our high-quality connection we have here. We're very happy to have that. And Dr. Weinberger, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue. So please stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
After mass killings, like at the movie theater in Colorado, everyone wonders, why did this happen? The killer's relatives are no exception.
Is there something wrong with us that this could emerge from us, that someone capable of murder could emerge from our family?
How the families of mass murderers react to what their loved ones did. That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. We're at midsection in the Commodity Futures Exchange. Corn harvesting going on right now in Arkansas and southern Illinois is putting some pressure on the cash market as well as future prices. Arkansas, while not a major producer of corn, the yields have been extremely strong. Of course, in Illinois, the corn being sold on the cash market is likely a combination of old supplies as well as some freshly harvested corn. For both, the start of harvest is adding a little bit of pressure to corn basis levels that have seen some declines in recent weeks as well. Meanwhile, over in the soybean pit, weather forecasts as well as uncertainty about what is going to happen at the Fed this afternoon relative to quantitative easing and potential glitches going on right now over on the Wall Street side have soybeans under pressure, especially in the front months. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat is now 873, down 19 and a half. March at 901 and three quarters, down 15 and a quarter. September wheat at the board at 867, down 21 and a